Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen. I'm the editor-at-large at SlashFilm.com, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I'm the features editor for Pajiba.com, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome back to A Cast of Kings, everyone.
It felt really good to say that.
Yes,
did it feel good?
We did the full naming this time. But yes, we are back. And the first thing we have to say is, wow. Right, Joanna?
Can I say wow? I am agog.
We are gobsmacked by your support for A Cast of Kings. When we launched the Kickstarter about a month ago, we had... I think there was serious doubt as to whether we would meet our goal. Correct, Joanna? I mean, I wasn't 100% sure we would, and I certainly did not think we would meet it within 48 hours. So to all the people that supported us, I would like to say thank you, and it's very gratifying and heartwarming and just very humbling that people thought that what we were doing with the Cast of Kings was worth supporting. Joanna, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just I am amazed. I don't mean to sound all like fake shock Anne Hathaway about it, but I really didn't think that it would go the way it went. And so we're really thankful. Now if you want a Cast of Kings movie, like the Veronica Mars movie, you only need to give us $2 million.
That is right. Correct. $2 million for a Cast of Kings movie. You're referring to Anne Hathaway's moment at the Oscars, right? Where she looked at her Oscar and she's like, it came true, as though it was like spontaneous, but we all know she rehearsed it 100 times. Is that what
right,
you're talking about?
I mean, I said that when I saw the Kickstarter reach its goal. That's exactly what I said.
She said it came true.
And then I also quoted Anne Hathaway and said, it's so creamy, because that's what she said about her Oscar, which is pretty gross.
I see. So. That does sound disgusting.
Yep.
And, you know, what I said was, you know, I hope one day the problems that people face in Game of Thrones can only be problems found in stories and not in reality. So... there you go.
So we're pretty much the best human beings around.
Exactly right. Anyway, so we're back, and we'll be back for the entire season, and we're going to be doing this with the support of you guys and a bunch of backers who have claimed some great rewards, which we will be sort of fulfilling throughout the course of this season. We're going to see how it goes. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, so I'm looking forward to trying it out. In the meantime, this is a bonus episode that we're recording right now to kind of recap the second season and sort of get us to the place that we are today, right before the beginning of the third season, which will premiere on HBO on March 31st at 9 p.m. And so the purpose of this episode is to talk about the first two seasons, talk about where we are and kind of what we're looking forward to, what plot lines we want to see resolved this season. Without giving away any spoilers, of course.
Of course.
Speaking of spoilers, if for some reason this is your first time listening to A Cast of Kings, you should know that we treat this as a television show and do not give away any spoilers from future episodes. That includes anything given away. Well, I guess we're going to talk about the trailers because I definitely have watched those. But in the future, we won't be giving away anything in the next time on Game of Thrones sort of previews. And even if you've read the book, right, no spoilers of any sort about, like, you know this is going to happen or you know this guy's going to die. I honestly think half of the enjoyment people get from listening to the show is listening to Joanna's verbal contortions trying to avoid spoilers.
Absolutely, as I hem and haw and stammer. And
that was at least half of the Kickstarter amount was as a result of people wanting to hear more of that. So
exactly.
So anyway... So let's get into it then, Joanna. So it's fair to say that you and I have rewatched the entire first two seasons of Game of Thrones in the last few weeks. Is that correct?
We sacrificed 20 hours of our lives sitting still watching.
Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do it. It's not an easy job. But yeah, I mean, I think we were both so, I guess, the Kickstarter really lit a fire under our butts. You know, we kind of were like, okay, we got to really brush up and make sure we know our stuff. So we rewatched the first two seasons, and I guess before we get to the final episode and start talking about where the plot lines are going to go, just any thoughts on the first two seasons and how season two compared to season one and so on and so forth. You know, which one did you like better or did you feel like, just any thoughts in general, Joanna?
Well, I know. Okay. Yes. I will say that I loved both seasons, but I think season one is better, and that's because I think book one is better. And it's something we talked about last season, which last season on the podcast, which is what George R. R. Martin's story becomes is further and further spread apart as he adds more characters, as those characters go off and have their own adventures. And so everything by necessity becomes just that more, much more spread out. And it's just too many plot lines. And okay, so I loved season two, but I'm just saying that's the reason why season two wasn't as good as season one, in my opinion, was because of that spread.
Yeah. I mean, so rewatching season one again, I am absolutely convinced again that it is a masterpiece. I mean, I do just think that the amount of work that went into conceiving this world, both by George R. R. Martin and Mr. Weiss and Mr. Benioff, it's just amazing what they're able to come up with, the scale, the scope of it. The casting by Nina Gold is just amazing. And, you know, I was watching all the special features because we are going to try to push out a season one and season two Blu-ray review episode between now and season three premiere, hopefully. I was watching the special features of the season one disc and season one Blu-ray disc set, and they're talking about how tricky it was to find the correct child actors for this series because you have a situation where you know these people, you're going to depend on them to carry the story over the course of the next, you know, 4 or 5 years or however long it's on the air. And it is tricky to know what type of person an actor will be 4 years from when you're casting them. You know, it's probably the same challenge that the Harry Potter people went through. But that paid off for them, and I think this gamble is paying off for them, for the Game of Thrones people.
Who do you think is the strongest child actor on the show right now?
Tough to say. I would say probably my favorites are Arya and Sansa. I think they do a pretty excellent job.
Yeah, so that's Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams. And I think for some reason, rewatching season two, Sophie Turner sort of edged it out for me. I thought her Sansa portrayal was really excellent.
Yeah, yeah, really strong. Just it's tricky what she's doing in season two, right? She's trying to play someone who is forced to behave a certain way, but not. But she doesn't do it so well that you don't know what she really feels.
Right.
And so that is a really difficult balance to strike. And I think she really does a great job at pulling off that balance in season two. But Arya is also pretty great. But I think that's primarily because of the character, the type of character that she's playing. You know, this spunky, anti-lady character, right? That is against the status quo. This is the same, basically the same girl from Brave, essentially. You know, the Pixar's Brave.
I know Pixar's Brave.
And that whole archetype that she's really doing well at. Her interactions with Tywin Lannister in season two were really a joy to behold. So those two child actors really take it. I don't have anything against the character, the actor who plays Bran. I just think he wasn't really given that much to do this season.
Right, and he'll have more to do, maybe, possibly.
Do we count Emilia Clarke as a child actor?
I don't know. How old was she when this show started?
I don't know, but she definitely doesn't look like a child actor. And
I wouldn't count her.
Yeah, and also, I mean, theoretically,
I wouldn't count the boys, the older boys either.
Right, like Robb Stark. Emilia Clarke, it looks like she is 26 years old right now. So,
right.
But, I mean, John, you know, one thing that you said during our original run of A Cast of Kings that really stuck with me was that Jon Snow is supposed to be 17 at season one, right?
Right.
Kit Harington. He does not look 17 at the beginning of season one.
No, I mean, right. He's supposed to be younger than that, I think, in the books.
Right, and they made him older for the show, right?
Oh, right. You mean in the show. Yeah, exactly.
Right, so...
No, he's manly. He's beardy.
Yeah. So there's kind of this interesting mix. Anyway, so as I was saying...
Oh, we would count Jack Gleason, who's playing Joffrey, who's also a magnificent bastard.
He is amazing. And so anyway, season one, I think, is truly a masterpiece. The storytelling just felt completely under control, right? It just felt like they knew everything that they were doing. They knew what they were setting up. They knew how to pay things off. And if I haven't said it, by the way, we should say, obviously, spoilers through everything through season two of Game of Thrones. But yeah.
Are y'all listening to this and haven't watched season one and season two yet?
I don't know.
What's going on?
That would be
there?
Really weird, but I'm sure there are people that are out there that are doing it. But yeah, things like huge developments like the Golden Crown episode, key episode. And of course, the episode when that really bad thing happens to Ned Stark, right? That. And watching the special features for season one, it was funny because they were talking about how in any normal show, you're thinking to yourself, man, how is he going to get out of this one, right? Like, what last second 11th hour save is going to come save Ned Stark? And of course, it doesn't come. And this is the type of show it is. It will introduce these characters and then kill them off. Characters who you might think are the protagonist of the show are killed off, right?
Right.
And it's bold. It's great storytelling. It's bold. It's well acted. It's beautifully conceived. Season one was just magnificent.
And I feel like the general sort of philosophy around George R. R. Martin's writing, for those who've read several of his books, is like odds are if you love a character, they're in danger. He like relishes that. So
then season two. Things really started to spin out of control. Now, I thought this when we recorded the Cast of Kings, our inaugural season of Cast of Kings. And I think it even more now after having rewatched both seasons. One big issue is you're adding in a bunch of new characters, right? So already it was tough in season one to balance all the characters. It was already difficult, right? Can we agree that was a difficult task that they pulled off? Right.
Right.
And then season two, you're adding a bunch of characters. You're adding Stannis, you're adding Renly, Margaery, you're adding Melisandre, Davos, his son, and who else am I missing, Joanna? You're adding
Brienne.
Brienne, right, the Night's Watch, more people from the Night's Watch, Ygritte.
Arya's friend.
Right, Arya's friends, the whole Arya Tywin Lannister interaction and all the characters surrounding that. Roz becomes kind of a major character in season two, right?
Yes.
What's her name? Hodor and the woman.
Asha,
that's right. Asha, yeah. Becomes a pretty significant character. So you're adding on all these characters onto an already pretty full plate, and it's likely that some characters are going to get short shrift. So that's one difficulty, but whatever, so maybe it's a little less focused. I think the far bigger crime of season two is people doing things because the script asks for it and not because it makes sense in the context of that scene or in the context of their character.
Can you give me an example?
I can give you a few examples.
Oh, all right.
Such as, for example, Daenerys not wanting to show off the dragons when the people at Karth asked her to go in. Like, we talked about this when that episode aired. It didn't make any sense to me. Did we ever resolve that question? Things like, why would the Night's Watch just leave Jon Snow to execute Ygritte? Yeah. Why would they just leave him there? Why not just stay the 5 seconds it would take to watch him execute?
They did a terrible job of that in the show, and it's done for a reason and really well in the book.
Right. When you and Miles were on the show talking about it, we're expecting it to be paid off later, and it never got paid off.
Yeah, right? Exactly. The Jon Snow plotline is one of my favorites, and they handled it very poorly, I thought. I love the actress who's playing Ygritte, and, there was parts of their interactions that I really loved, but it's a better story in the book than this sort of rom-com road trip that they did. And
is it possible that they will pay it off in season three? No, it's that whole thing is over, because at the end of season two, Corrin Halfhand is killed, right? And I assume that was like the conclusion of what was supposed to happen between them, right?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And Corrin Halfhand being killed.
What happens in the book is Corrin says essentially, I did this on purpose to see what kind of man you are. And if you had gone through with it, I would have known you were that kind of man. And if you didn't go through with it, I would know you were that kind of man. You know what I mean? And not go through with it is not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Necessarily in Corrin's book. So it was a test. It wasn't like an accident. It was a test, basically.
Right.
And there was no wrong answer. It was just sort of to get the measure of the man, if that makes sense.
So that whole thing was jettisoned completely in the show.
Yeah, exactly.
And when Corrin is killed, it just comes off as really lame, because Ygritte says, you can tell Mance Rayder, that's the man who killed Corrin Halfhand, and it's like, oh, is that supposed to be a big revelation? Because it was a crime of passion. Do you know what I mean? In the show.
Well, no. I think in the show they still did a job of showing that this was a plan that Corrin sort of tried to communicate to John, that this is the plan. The plan is you kill me and then you ingratiate yourself this way with, you know, these people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I certainly got that. I don't know how well it was communicated in the show.
Right. Sure.
So
yeah, it was handled so poorly, and I don't understand why. When it was there just is no reason why. There are reasons why they changed some of the plot lines, and I get it. And this is one where I just don't get it. So
right. So so those are a couple of some of, like, the bigger crimes of season two. Like Jon Snow in particular, I think was pretty poorly handled. Where you're just kind of scratching your head and being like, why are these characters doing this and doing that? So I think another thing that really, really got me very angry was the whole Jaime Lannister situation. Like, he's captured and then he breaks out and then he captured and then he breaks out. Right. That's his kind of plot. That's his arc for season two. And it just struck me as like, okay, it's already implausible. This is literally the most valuable person that you have possession of. Your most valued bargaining chip is this human being. You're telling me you would not have like double and triplicate form of making sure he does not escape. That just struck me as totally implausible.
That was another... Oh my God, we're just falling into old patterns. Which, yes. Is Dave is pissed at the show, and I'm like, well, in the book...
Right. No, it's good. It's good. Like, it's good. I think it's good to have that differentiation, because I think things that are fine in the book... don't come off too well in the show, because a lot gets lost in translation. So
yeah, in the I don't know why they didn't do it this way, but in the book, Catelyn has just found out about, because she thinks her sons are dead. She's just found out she thinks her sons are dead.
Right.
So she's grief stricken and desperate to get her daughters back, and this seems to be the only way she can get her daughters back.
Right.
Is by letting Jaime go. So, like, I know that doesn't speak to your like security issue around the cage or whatever, but it does speak to why Catelyn. What her motivation is. It's not just she's stupid, you know? And I think a lot of people were like, Catelyn's so dumb. Catelyn does a lot of dumb stuff. But in this case, she's absolutely grief-stricken, and all she can think is, how can I get my daughters back? I don't even care about losing the war if I get my daughters back.
Right, right.
And in the book, she's counting not on Jaime's honor, but on Tyrion's honor. And Tyrion, you know, Tyrion is basically offering this trade for her.
Well,
and
it was through Littlefinger you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So.
Right. So, you know, those are the three big moments that stuck out to me as being pretty critical to the plot and not making any sense on a character level. So those were the reasons why kind of season two fell apart, is that the shorter shrift was given to each character. And then, you know, some characters made some really dumb decisions, basically.
Right? Yeah. So here's my note for Benioff and Weiss. For every character that you add, give us an extra episode for the season. I don't think that's unreasonable to ask.
Yeah. Seriously. Come on, guys. I'm sure they're listening to this right now.
They are our number one donator for the Kickstarter.
Not really. So, aside from that, I think there's some pretty awesome stuff in season two, actually. And... I think by far the best plotline is Theon's plotline.
First time I saw Winterfell, it looked like something that had been here for thousands of years and would be here for thousands of years after I was dead. I saw it and I thought, of course Ned Stark crushed our rebellion and killed my brothers. We never stood a chance against the man who lives here.
Lord Stark went out of his way to make it your home.
Yes, my captors were so very kind to me. You love reminding me of that. Everyone in this frozen pile of shit has always loved reminding me of that. You know what it's like to be told how lucky you are to be someone's prisoner? To be told how much you owe them? And then to go back home to your real father.
I mean, I think here's a situation where the show does this amazing thing by taking this minor character who is kind of in the background for the whole of season one and brings him front and center and has been seeding in all these character elements through season one about how he kind of has this connection to Roz. He's kind of lonely because he has no place to call home. And then when he finally goes home, right, like the people don't welcome him with open arms. They hate him.
Right.
And so he has no loyalty. And then he ends up doing all the – he makes these terrible decisions because he can't stand up for what he really believes in. Maybe he doesn't even know what he really believes in. Just a really tragic figure and almost Shakespearean in the amount of tragedy that he suffers.
Well, yeah, and I remember you saying this last year, that he was the one that you just felt the most sort of pathos for. I think the best plot line, though, I think hands down, is Tyrion Lannister's plot line. I think – that takes a place above Theon for me in terms of his arc this season, and especially the tragedy of his tragedy in the final episode. I know we're going to talk more in depth about the season two finale, but the season builds and builds and builds and builds until he's on top and then he falls so far, you know? And then he's unwilling to leave it, even though he's fallen so far, he's unwilling to leave it because he says, heartbreakingly so, he says, this is the only thing I've ever really loved doing, outwitting these people, being on top, you know? And so he won't leave when he should. We all know he should. And the same thing is true of Theon. You know, Master Luwin says, go, run, join the Night's Watch, run. And he's like, no, no, right. You know? And so both of them are just taken down. Well, you know, Tyrion was already taken down, but, you know, like both of them just refuse to let go when they should be cashing their chips in, you know.
And I think there's something to be said about that. There's something to – like there's that's a thematic thing within the show, a thematic motif within the show that people can't get away from what they think they're good at or that they become trapped – because of their own machinations, right? And they can't extricate themselves.
Well, but I mean, I feel like George R. R. Martin, though, is sort of like you're screwed no matter what, though, because with Ned Stark in season one, he did give over. Like he clung stubbornly to his honor for a while, but then he gave over and he still got, you know, his head chopped off.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think that George R. R. Martin has got a strong thesis as to what you can do to survive. He's sort of like, you're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't across the board when the stakes are as high as they are in the Game of Thrones.
Oh, nice. I like how you. Hey, that's the title of the show, Joanne.
Hey, that's the name of the show.
Any other thoughts on season two? Again, I agree. I think the Theon plotline is great. I think the Arya plotline, you can only sort of cry wolf so many times with the Arya plotline, right? Where like she has numerous sort of time. Like at first you're like, oh my gosh, is she gonna save Ned Stark in season one? And then this season, she has a chance to stab Tywin Lannister in the neck. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I wonder how many more times they're gonna be like, hey, Arya might be able to do this. But she's probably not going to. There's only so many.
I think that's completely unfair.
Okay.
I think that's completely unfair because at the end of season one, she kills a boy. She stabs someone at the end of season one.
I guess a nobody, but yeah.
A nobody. And then in season two, with her intelligence, she takes down an entire castle and escapes, basically. By using, you know, Jack and Hagar.
Oh yeah, that was another thing. Let's talk about that. But continue what you're saying, defending Arya.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, she thinks her way out of an untenable situation.
Right.
And that's so I feel like you're saying she's almost a badass. No, she's a badass.
Okay.
She thinks her way. I mean, like, she saves Gendry when they're like ambushed and they're like trying to find Gendry and she's like, oh, you already killed him. He's over there. You know, like she keeps thinking her way out of plot lines. And as you say, she's that plucky, spunky, you know, young female, whatever. And we love her. And I don't think she's almost a badass. I think she is a badass.
Okay. That's a fair point.
She's not a Brienne level badass yet. Brienne is a different animal altogether. So.
Yeah. Brienne is Arya in like 30 years.
Fingers crossed, guys.
So let's actually talk about that. That's actually the third thing about season two, right? First, the first two are like too many characters and also like characters making dumb decisions. But the third thing that really bothered me is the sort of level of magic and how poorly the rules are communicated to the viewer. Because in season one, I thought the level of magic or mystical elements was perfect. You had kind of hints of things going on, right? You had these moments with Daenerys where she picks up the dragon egg and doesn't burn herself, and she walks into the pyre at the end, and then these dragons come out, and she survives, and it's like, whoa. There's just this kind of hint there, and at the end, it's made explicit. I did not know that it would be kind of breaking that last scene of season one would kind of be tapping the keg of magic, as it were, for this show.
No one prepared you for smoke babies?
No one prepared me for smoke babies. Smoke baby assassins and, you know, people like teleporting people in Karth and so on and so forth, right? Like, I think the smoke baby is really the one that messes me up because, correct me if I'm wrong, Joanna, I mean, I voiced this complaint to you during the original Cast of Kings, but is it or is it not true that they did not, like, really explain what the rules of the smoke baby were in the show?
I want to know why you need to know the rules of the smoke baby.
Because if you don't know the rules, you can just basically make stuff up. Right. In order for there to be stakes, you need to understand, like, why doesn't the smoke baby just appear on King's Landing and cut Tyrion's throat? Right. You know, like, why doesn't a bunch of random stuff happen with a smoke baby? Because if you have a smoke baby, that is like a trump card. Like, if I had a smoke baby, Joanna, I would pull out that trump card virtually all the time. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
You do. I know you know what I mean. So why doesn't the smoke baby just take care of all of Stannis' problems? That kind of bothered me. And if it's not going to take care of the problems, you need to explain why. You can't just expect us to forget that we saw a smoke baby.
I don't think they're expecting you to forget. They seared that image on your brain. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a matter of proximity, but you're right that they – I mean, but how boring would that be to sit down and be like, okay, here are the do's and the don'ts of the smoke baby. There's so much
you don't need to sit down. You just
need to. There's so much exposition they have to get through in this universe building.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're right, because Game of Thrones never does exposition.
That's true. That's true. You know what? They should have gotten Roz to nakedly explain the rules of the smoke baby assassin.
That's right. That's right. While she's having, in all seriousness though, right? The show is like 80% exposition.
Yeah.
So why not have literally a 2-minute scene where they kind of go over the rules of the smoke baby? She wouldn't say, "Here are the rules of the smoke baby." You know, they could integrate it organically into the scene. But
right, it's while Stannis is like railing her on the giant battle map table.
Exactly. You know,
she's
could have
like,
said,
"Oh my lord, P.S. These are the rules of the smoke baby we're making right now."
Exactly.
All right.
But in all seriousness, you know, that there are these kind of elements like and the teleportation guy in Karth, right? Like, why doesn't he just kill everyone? Or why doesn't he kill Ser Jorah Mormont? You know, why does he kind of just...
Because then I would stop watching the show.
I know, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's just all these, if you introduce magic, you need to establish parameters or else things just don't have any stakes. You could just be like, well, at any time, Neo can just fly off from the fight. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's the other big beef. And I don't know how they're going to solve that in season three or if they're even going to solve it. But I have a feeling we haven't seen the end of magical things happening in Game of Thrones.
Okay, so. I don't want to spoil anything for you, but no.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? So that's a concern for me is are they going to be better at establishing these parameters? Maybe they will. We'll see. So any other thoughts or shall we get to the final episode of season two?
Let's do it, man.
I do have one last thought I want to give. This is not a complaint. This is actually a good thing. I was watching that Seven Devils trailer again because it's such a gorgeous trailer. And
it is.
The thing you have to admire about season two is, you have problems with all these characters scattered to the different parts of this world. But one of the benefits of that is that the show is just so freaking gorgeous. You know, that they went and filmed in all these amazing locations and are really showing you something that it's hard to see anywhere else. Even the opening episode of season two on the beach with Melisandre and all the idols burning on the beach.
Yeah.
Such a gorgeous, like, every time I watch Game of Thrones, I think to myself, man, someone had to location scout this, carve those idols, ship them out to the freaking middle of nowhere and set them on fire.
And then burn them.
Yeah, and then gather all these extras together and have this kind of conceive of what this sort of God-burning ceremony would be like and shoot it, right? Yeah. And just it's just mind-boggling the amount of work that goes into that. So despite all my complaints about season two, it does show you a lot of things that you just have never seen before and probably are not likely to see outside of the show. And, of course, the pinnacle of this is Blackwater, Season 2, Episode 9, directed by Neil Marshall. Just a magnificent episode that really stands on its own as a short film of sorts. So I don't want it to be all negative on Season 2. Just wanted to throw that out
there.
Yeah,
and I also want to point out that in addition to the beautiful locations, I'm sort of on record as saying that I hate CGI in general. We've talked about this before. But the map painting, I think it's called, right? Map painting. Is amazing.
It's not just map. It's like some digital compositing that they use, where they make a setting that doesn't look like a huge castle look like a huge castle.
Right. Yeah. So like Harrenhal, like when you see Harrenhal before the effects, and then you see it after, or you know, once again, I was watching the finale earlier today, rewatching it for I think the third time, and when Daenerys is walking through that snowy throne room, it's just one of the most astonishingly beautiful shots. And
I kept thinking, like, how did they even do that? Because they had to take the original throne room and like strip it down and like cover it with snow. You know, that probably was the last shot they did, I'm guessing.
That's beautiful.
But yeah, it's amazing. And just like the show is very generous. You know, it doesn't have to show you all that stuff, but it does show you.
Right.
And as a result, you have this gorgeous imagery that's going to live forever. So. Pretty spectacular stuff. So it's not all bad for season two. There's some great plot lines and some great visuals. And so want to make sure that I present that balanced perspective. So let's move on into a recap of the final episode of season two of Game of Thrones. So when this episode begins, you have I should say when season two, episode nine ended, Tyrion had just got sort of slashed in the face, and Pod had saved him, right?
Right.
And he wakes up at the beginning of this episode, season two, episode 10, kind of groggy and not really understanding what happens. I was not sure he had survived until I saw this episode.
Right.
I was actually told, Joanna, that in the books, Tyrion is quite a bit more disfigured than he is in the show.
Absolutely. He loses his nose.
Right. So I'm guessing they thought that would just be impractical.
We have to already CGI a lot of things. We have to CGI
his nose in every single scene. You know, that would have been pretty tricky. So
yeah, so they gave him just like, it's kind of a dashing scar that he has.
Yeah, it's not, I would not call him that disfigured. I mean, it could have been a worse scar, but I guess that, you know, they were trying to skip on makeup as well. So whatever. So he wakes up looking at the worst person possible, Maester Pycelle, who he had, I think he had him beaten, right? Not too long ago, previous to this episode.
Yeah, and cut his beard off, indignity of indignities.
Right. So wakes up and finds out that sort of Tywin Lannister has returned, that he is no longer Hand of the King, and that the King's Guard has kind of, Bronn, right, is no longer in charge of the King's Guard.
Right. So Bronn has been relieved of his duty and all his hill people are gone. And so all of his protection and basically, you know, team Tyrion has been disbanded.
Right.
So.
Right. To the outer world, it is Joffrey who has gotten the credit for the victory. Right.
Well, it's Tywin. It's his father.
Sure.
That got the victory. You know, that Tywin came in with the Tyrells and saved the day. And that's, I mean, the outrage. He worked all freaking season long to secure this victory, and it will go unheralded. And it's so sad.
Right. So. And that's when he has that scene with Shay. And, you know, Shay's
actually later in the episode, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
That's okay.
So then there's a scene between Roz and Varys, which, tell me, Joanna, like, did you see this scene coming? So to speak.
No.
So to speak. I mean, like, I have no idea what the future holds for these two characters, but it kind of came out of nowhere, right? As it were. it emerged from nowhere. right? That
I mean, basically, though, the scene previous, you see Lord Baelish, Littlefinger, get Harrenhal, and he and Lord Varys are sort of in this one-upsmanship, you know, who's the best sort of little spy in the kingdom, and it looks like Littlefinger has defeated him. And so Varys goes to Roz, who's, you know, works for Littlefinger, and obviously he's laying the groundwork to try to take down Littlefinger, I think.
I see.
You know, where that's coming from. But Roz is not in the book, as we've already discussed.
Right. So, and Varys saying, like, I think you have gifts that da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, look, I think Roz is cool, but I don't understand what appeal she would hold to Varys. But what your explanation makes sense to me.
And now she's going to be like, I don't know, a sexy spy. Exciting.
Varys just seemed so genuine, you know, when he was saying how awesome she was. So I was just kind of like, where is this coming from?
Well, Varys is such an interesting character, and I loved rewatching his stuff on this rewatch because he genuinely is working for the good of the kingdom.
Right.
Littlefinger is working for the good of himself, and Varys is genuinely working for the good of the kingdom. And he has a scene with Tyrion in this episode. It comes a little later, but he has a scene where he's genuinely like, we are friends, and I thank you for saving the kingdom. You're amazing. I can't really associate you with you right now politically, but, like, you know, he doesn't just cut him. He tries to help him. And so it's – Varys is such an interesting character because he has this this weird integrity. He's so manipulative, but he has a weird integrity to him.
Right, and that was evident in season one as well when he was talking with Ned in the dungeon.
Right, exactly.
Now Ned's like, what is your end game here? And he's like, I serve the kingdom.
Right.
I'm already skipping over scenes, John. I'm out of practice. We skipped the second scene where Tywin Lannister rides into the throne room after his horse takes a dump. And, you know, so Tywin is made Hand of the King again.
Right.
And then you said Lord Baelish is given Harrenhal. And then Joffrey is engaged to Marjorie Tyrell. Now, here's a question that I had during this scene is when Joffrey says words to the effect of, oh, I can't go back on my word. What is going through Joffrey's mind at that point? Like, has this whole thing with Maester Pycelle been engineered? Or is Joffrey being genuine when he says, oh, I don't want to not marry Sansa? Like, I don't think that is ever revealed. Like,
I don't think Joffrey has a genuine bone in his body. I think he's demurring for, like, you know, to save face or whatever, so that both Pycelle and, freaking Cersei, you know, are the ones who are like, no, no, my lord, it's fine, you can do it. You know, it's all politics.
Right.
So, right. No, I don't think there's a second.
The issue with that is that Joffrey has proven himself really bad at politics in the past, right? In the sense that he cut off Ned Stark's head. Do you know what I mean? And that was a politically stupid decision, because if he had let Ned Stark go, it would have likely quelled the rebellion in the North. Right?
Yeah.
So
he also killed a lot of babies.
So. Right. So do you know what I mean? So when you say, oh, he's this political genius.
No, I don't think he's a political genius. I think Cersei's like, hey, this is what we're gonna do today. And Joffrey's like, all right, I'll do that today. You know, on other days he'd be like, no, mother, I'm going to beat a whore, or like whatever it is that Joffrey likes to do for his jollies. But today he played, you know, he played the good king.
All right. Again, I don't see him playing the good king. Again, I just don't fully buy that, because he has not been playing the good king throughout this entire season. And in fact, Cersei has like a mental breakdown because she essentially resigns herself to the fact that she can't control him. So I just don't buy that explanation. I'm still not 100% sure what's going on in this scene. If you have an opinion, email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Anyway, moving on. So then
I missed everyone's emails.
So then we already talked about Ross and Varys, and then Brienne and Jaime have this awesome scene where they
come upon all these women, these barmaids, who have been killed by Stark men. They're hung up, and there's a sign that says, you know, they laid with lions, and they were killed by Stark men. And then they come upon Jaime and Brienne come upon these men that killed these women, and Brienne kills them all. And Jaime's like, those were Stark men. Don't you serve Starks? And Brienne's like, no, I serve Lady Catelyn. And those, you know, those guys were bad guys. She has this very rigid sense of honor, you know, and the fact that they killed these barmaids just because they had sex with Lannister men, you know, really drives her crazy. So,
yeah. Why did they kill the barmaids again exactly? Can you explain that?
Okay, so they're on the Stark side.
Yep, I get that.
And these barmaids slept with people on the Lannister side.
I see. So they just killed them for that reason.
They laid with lions. They slept with Lannister men, so they kill them.
I see. So...
I think they raped one of them, at least. So, good times.
Well, because, yeah, he says two of them we gave slow quick
right.
deaths. But, yeah, I would say that was disproportionate punishment for those women. Would you say that?
Yeah, I would say they did not have that coming.
Okay. All right. Anyway, Robin...
I mean, and it just sort of proves... And what you see from Jaime is a bit of a growing admiration for Brienne.
Right. Exactly. I would say the same. Their interaction is pretty awesome. Jamie just has such a quick wit, you know, all the time. It's pretty funny. So then,
Something I'll say for the book, for Storm of Swords, for the first time you get Jamie Lannister as a point of view character, because you'll remember that each of the chapters are written from a point of view character, and they sort of come and go in the books. And as you would imagine, you know, like Theon is a point of view character in the second book and not in the first, you know, so the way they draw characters out that way. And so Jaime's a point of view character in the third book. And so you get this new side of him, you know, because you're inside of his head in
right.
the third book, and you just see a new side of him that you didn't see before because you get to see what's going on internally. And so I'm really looking forward
to that. So let's see if they actually pay that off. Right?
Yeah,
exactly. In the show. Mm-hmm. So then Rob and Catelyn have an argument, and we got a little bit of crap last season, and I think rightfully so for giving too much crap to this Rob and Talisa relationship. And rewatching it, I have to say, I don't think the relationship was that poorly done in the show. I think it's just a matter of the fact that I just don't give a crap about this relationship because so much other interesting stuff is happening. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So it wasn't that it was a badly done romance. It was just that it was the least, you know, the last thing that I cared about. Like, you know, I wanted to see how this war would continue and so on and so forth. I wanted to see how Tyrion would face off against the Stannis and so on and so forth. So that being said, it kind of is interesting that, like, this whole thing about promising to marry, what's that gentleman's name? Is it?
Walder Frey.
Yeah, Frey, right? One of Frey's daughters.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite moments in season one was when Robb Stark asked Catelyn if she had seen Frey's daughters and if any of them were attractive.
Right.
And she's like, one of them was... And then she just trails off.
Yeah, Michelle Fairley's face in that scene is so funny. She's like,
no, one of them was kind of acceptable, right? And so that was pretty funny. But what I like about this relationship and this kind of commitment, you know, Catelyn does say, treat your oaths recklessly and your people will do the same. And so there is something to that, right? But the whole Frey situation was so long ago. You know, in the timeline of the show,
right.
It was like a whole season ago,
right.
And it's true, like in Rob's mind too, that it was so long ago because he wanted that bridge because he thought he could save his dad, and now that he can't anymore, it's kind of like, well, why am I sort of paying off this promise that is not even that important to me anymore?
Right.
So I did kind of feel that this time that he was kind of being forced into the situation that he really didn't want to be in the first place.
Well, it's like, are you a king or are you a man? You know what I mean? Like, if you're a king, you have to do plenty of things you don't want to do.
Right.
And if you're a man, you get to marry the really pretty, you know, nurse. So are you a king and taking on the responsibilities of a king, or are you a man and doing what you want to do as a man? And we see that with Daenerys at the end of this episode, not to like jump too far ahead, but she has that whole sequence in the House of the Undying where she sees Khal Drogo and she sees her baby. And, you know, we all know that it's like a vision or whatever, but she leaves them because that's what she as a woman wants to do, but she wants to be a queen.
Right.
And as a queen, she has to leave them and go get the dragons because, you know, so it's that push and pull of duty and honor and all of that. And who can really take that on? And they're children. once again, you know, we said that these people aren't child actors, but they're children and they're being forced to make these really hard decisions.
So. Right. So then we get a scene with Stannis and Melisandre doing the post-game debrief of how that battle went. Really, really poorly for Stannis.
How did that old Blackwater battle go?
Yeah. And, you know, Stannis makes some pretty good points. I find the most interesting thing about the show is how it mirrors certain elements of our own reality, our universe. And so the whole relationship between Stannis and this sort of cult god is kind of interesting. Partially because we know, and again, this goes towards one of my complaints, like we know that Melisandre in fact does have powers, right? That she demonstrated this in season 2, episode 1, when she drinks the poison and survives.
Right.
She has a smoke baby. To what extent are these powers, right? Why were they not present during the battle? You know, what is she able to do? What is she not able to do? It's frustrating.
Well, that's because Davos said no Melisandre at the battle.
Oh, that's right. No. Good point. Good point about that. I apologize for forgetting
Davos
that part.
Davos says you have to win this as a man or right. else they'll never respect you.
No. Good point.
Bad mood, Davos. Bad mood.
Yeah. That was a dreaded miscalculation. So anyway, they talk about sort of what is going to happen. And she basically says, right, that thousands more will die before this whole thing is over. And Stannis looks into a fire and it's just left ambiguous what Stannis sees.
I love his face though. I put some images in our rundown this week that Dave and I are looking at, and I had to include this one of Stannis because I just love his face. He's like gazing into the fire face.
Well, it's just ambiguous. You don't know. Is he looking at something amazing or something horrifying or probably both?
But we hear the sound of battle, right, when he looks into the fire?
I don't recall that exactly, but okay. That doesn't sound outside of the realm of possibility. Then we get the Theon storyline. Now the Theon storyline up to this point is that I think Rob had offered amnesty to the Northmen if they basically left. Is that correct? Right.
Right. Right.
With the exception of Theon. So Theon gives this actually pretty freaking good rousing speech to people.
Right.
And then, you know. Is knocked downward. But this happens after he kind of has this moment of reflection in one of my favorite scenes of the entire season, where he's kind of staring into the fire and contemplating his existence. And contemplating like how he could have done these horrible things. You know?
Right.
This moment of pure humanity that he's like, I've done things I'd never thought I was capable of. Or I've done a lot of things I never thought I would do, and it's true. You know, he's not the type of person that he's pretends to be. And
Alfie Allen did a really great job with that. The actor who plays Theon, Lily Allen's brother. I agree that he really did a great job of laying on those layers of sorrow to, you know, I mean, Theon is a really shitty person. Even when he went home, you know, he's just kind of a shitty person. But you can't help but feel for him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, a show has succeeded when it makes you feel sympathy for someone who is a horrible human being.
Right.
So, anyway, so they do a speech and then he gets knocked out and presumably, we don't know. But presumably he's going to get turned over to the Stark men, although I don't know what's going to happen this season. I'm very curious what's going to become of Theon. I also really like that scene between Theon and his sister a couple episodes earlier where she kind of tells that story of how he was a horrible baby and she says to him, you know, please don't die here, brother, essentially. Just kind of giving him this moment of connection that he never had in his entire life.
Right.
So yeah, you really feel bad for him. I don't know what's going to become of him. I'm guessing nothing good. Anyway, we go back to
this is when the listeners can hear my silence crackling along the lines.
What do you mean?
As I say nothing. as you're like, I'm interested to see what happens to Theon, and I say nothing.
Oh yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I'm glad because otherwise we'd have a podcast ending fight about it.
Brawl.
So then we go to the scene back with Tyrion where Varys explains to him the state of things and Shay comes in and essentially sort of with words, cements her relationship with Tyrion, right?
Yeah, and she's the one who unwraps his face. She's like, let me be the first to see. And she says, let's go. Let's just get the fuck out of here and go build a life together. And he says, no.
Come back. You don't belong here.
What would we do in Pentos?
Eat, drink, fuck, live.
I want to go with you.
So do it. Your father, your sister, all these bad people, they can't stop you. Forget about them. Come with me.
I can't. I do belong here. These bad people. What I'm good at. Out talking them, out thinking them. It's what I am. And I like it. I like it more than anything I've ever done. Are you going to leave?
You have a shit memory. I am yours, and you are mine.
And
so you've already talked about that decision. I mean, what do you think of this whole... I guess one question I have is, do you buy this relationship? Because we know Tyrion has been set up from the beginning as a sort of someone who sleeps around and enjoys prostitutes and likes his alcohol and so on and so forth. Do you think Tyrion is really ready to settle down?
Yeah, absolutely. Do I buy how he feels about her? Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I feel like he has been looking for someone like her his whole life. And in fact, you know, when he tells a story of his previous wife, like exactly like her, you know, and all Tyrion wants is to be loved. He's been so rejected and put down his entire life. And all he wants is the like tender love and affection that he never gets from his family, that he barely gets from Jaime, that he never gets from his family. And, you know, everything he's done this season is to try to win admiration from his family. And he got screwed, you know?
Right.
So the Shay is so important to him, hugely important to him.
I think I'm pretty close to where you are on this, Joanna. I think Shay has a thick accent, but I don't know. I just feel like I just am not that impressed with her as an actress. I don't know if it's the accent or if it's her actual acting ability. It's tough to say. I'm going to be just honest. Like, I don't know if it's because of the accent, and I don't want to discriminate, you know what I mean? But at the same time...
The Turkish people of the world are very upset that you said
this. Is she Turkish? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, she's Turkish.
I see.
She was in a very good movie called Again... Well, I mean, she's been in a lot of pornography, and so people will bring that up often, but she's also in a very good movie where she kept her clothes on for most of the time called Against the Wall, a German movie, and she was great in that.
Against the Wall was not a porn movie, you're saying?
No, it was not.
Okay.
She's fantastic in that. And so I agree that there are some actors who are just much better in their native language. I think Penelope Cruz is much better in her native language, you know, and I don't think it's discriminatory to say so. She's, you know, she's done plenty of beautiful English language films, but I think she's just got an extra depth in her native language.
Right.
And I could say that I would easily agree with you that the same is true for this actress. So
then Rob and Talisa, we see this marriage scene with them. We get to learn what the Game of Thrones world marriage vows are like, which is kind of cool. Who knows?
Depending on which gods you get married under.
Right. And then let's talk a little bit about the Daenerys storyline and just how that wraps up. So she goes to the House of the Undying and she's about to be chained up, and then she breaks free because her dragons, now empowered by her presence, are able to just nuke that guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that was pretty cool, but we talked about this when we originally broadcast, how felt like a lot of buildup for not that much payoff, right? The whole season has basically been building up to that one moment, right? And it is pretty good. Right, it's pretty good, but it's not.
It's all right.
Yeah, it's all right. That's kind of how I feel about it. Do your thoughts?
Yeah, the House of the Undying chapter in the book is one of the greatest chapters. And honestly, they could have done a whole episode of her wandering around the House of the Undying and all the visions she's shown and stuff like that. It would be a trippy, weird, stupid episode that most people wouldn't like. I would like it. Book lovers would like it. But other people would be like, who's that guy now? Who is she talking to? Why? No one would care. So they truncated it. And, you know, so she is in the throne room and in the tent and that's about it. But yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is Daenerys isn't in much of book two. And so I feel like they drew out her plot line in order to keep her in as much as possible.
Right.
So that you wouldn't forget about Emilia Clarke out in the desert. And in doing so, it sort of weakens the plot line.
I'm really curious if they're going to take the same tactic for season three.
Like, and I don't, you know, from everything I've heard, what they're doing now is, and George R. R. Martin's storytelling lends itself to this, is characters, I've said this before, characters just straight up disappear in books, upcoming books. And so I think what Benioff and Weiss have suggested they're going to do is weave the books, pay less attention to the chronology of when George R. R. Martin wrote it. And I know for a fact, given some things that I've seen in the preview of certain characters, that they are weaving other books into it.
Right.
And so I don't think you'll have that problem, because what they're going to do is sort of weave together the strongest narrative they can by taking the best bits and putting it all together. That's my hope of what they do.
So I'm going to ask you not to respond to anything I'm about to say, but I will say that when I saw the trailer for season three, I'm going to give away a very minor thing from the trailer, which is that there are dragons in it. There are dragons. The dragons make an appearance. And actually, they actually make a prominent appearance in this trailer. And so when I tweeted about the trailer, someone responded, they thought that there was too much dragon. That sort of the trailer was overselling the dragons, because this person thought that they won't actually appear too much in this season. So I'm kind of curious when we get to it, I'm going to be curious, like, how prominently are the dragons going to be displayed, and how well does it jive with book three, from Game of Thrones series. So, anyway, so she gets her dragons back. And again, like we talked about how, to go to your point about how they're going to tell the story, we talked about in Blackwater how, they focused that entire episode in one location and on just a very small group of characters, and whether they would do the same thing, again. Right, because that was one of the most effective episodes. So I'm very curious if that's going to happen. Seems like
I think, you know, what we've seen so far, really not spoiling anything. This is based on, well, it's also based on information from episode titles that have been released. But
okay, let's not.
No. What I'm going to say is that in season one and in season two, the biggest showcase episodes were episodes 9.
Yes.
In season 1, it was Baylor when Ned lost his head in episode 9. Yeah. And in season 2, it's Blackwater, episode 9. So what I'm saying is that I wouldn't be surprised if they did that in episode 9 of season 3.
Like, have a huge episode.
Right.
Yes.
But as you say, focused. Narrowly focused.
Right.
See, that was pretty good.
Pretty good, Joanna. Pretty good. Pretty good. To that point, you know, it actually, from what I've heard of the new Arrested Development that's going to be premiering on Netflix, that's actually what they're going to do, is what I hear. That each episode is kind of going to be focusing on one character from the whole cast, because it was difficult to get the whole cast back together.
Oh, interesting.
So, like, each episode will tell the story of one character until they all reunite at the end. So I'll be interested to see that, and to see how Game of Thrones pans out, and whether they adopt this storytelling mechanic with all these characters. Anyway, all right. So then the Arya storyline wraps up. Jack and Hagar, who proves to be the most. Oh, that was another thing. That was another sort of magical element. Is Jack and Hagar, who is a shapeshifter apparently and can kill dudes.
He's a faceless man.
Right. So, you know, he started off as kind of this creepy ass dude in this cage, and ends up being a really key ally for Arya.
And it was her, what's the word I want? Sympathy.
Ingenuity?
For him.
Oh, okay.
Well, not just ingenuity, but just like it's like the classic fairy tale story. Okay. The classic fairy tale story is that, you know, the woodsman's youngest son or the king's youngest son or whatever, he takes pity on the crone and, you know, before he knows anything about her powers, does something nice for her to help her, and then later is rewarded. And that's what happens with Arya, is she saves Jaqen and the two like degenerates that are with him in that cage from fire, and then she's rewarded later because right. she saved him.
Right.
So that's a very classic fairy tale story that I love seeing.
Yeah, she got rewarded pretty big. I'd
yeah,
say.
Big time.
Yeah. And then she says she can't go with him to the magical land he's going off to. And
Braavos.
Yeah. And that's kind of the end of that.
But he gives her a coin.
And yeah.
And a catchphrase.
Right.
So there you go.
Then there's the Jon Snow storyline wraps up. I think we don't need to talk about this anymore, right? I think we covered it in our
Yeah, we did cover that. Yeah. And we do want to mention Asha and Bram and Rickon and Hodor and how poor Maester Pycelle dies.
No, Maester Luwin.
Maester Luwin. Yeah.
We want Maester Pycelle to die.
We do, and we didn't want Maester Luwin to die.
Yeah, he's such a cool guy, and that actor really gave that role.
He did.
A lot more than probably was on the page. He just he exudes sort of dignity and what's the word I'm looking for?
Gravitas.
Yeah, that's right. Gravitas. That's right. Awesome. I was like grave something. I know that's not right. And then the final scenes of this episode are Dany locking Zaro and her handmaiden in the vault, which had nothing in it. I don't know what exactly his plan was when he opened that thing and there was nothing in it.
Zaro?
Yeah.
Smoke and mirrors.
He's going to convince her, like, marry me and you'll have everything in the vault. And then she marries him and then she's just – and then there's nothing in there and he's just going to be cool with it. She's just going to be cool with it, right? Is that what – he was hoping for?
Well, yeah, he's so sexy. How could you not?
Yeah, I guess. and she and Jorah are essentially say, well, we have enough riches to sort of buy an army. Apparently, it's open season on Karth since the 13 are dead and Zaro is locked up and the House of the Undying guy has been burned alive, right?
Like, right.
Now, the people who stuck by their Khaleesi are rewarded for their patience.
Exactly.
Because they get to totally, like, sack this place.
Yep.
They get
all the goblets, all the jewel-encrusted goblets they could ever want.
It's a pretty minor sacking in the show, right? There's no raping going on.
No. I mean, it's like a gentle sacking.
Yeah, it's a pretty gentle... Yeah. No, I'm being serious. Yeah, yeah. I'm being serious.
No, I know. Yeah. I agree.
Is it a gentle sacking in the book?
It doesn't happen this way in the book.
Okay.
I just can't even talk about it.
Okay, fair enough. Oh, I should also mention, at this stage, Winterfell has essentially been burned down. Is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, wait, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about is, wasn't the deal that if they left, that Robb would spare their lives, but then they just burned everything down? So wouldn't that further inflame Robb Stark?
There's another element at play, and I have to confess that I need to suss it out. So let's talk about it next time.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Okay. We'll follow up on Winterfell burning next
time. Yeah. There's another.
Twist.
There are other characters at play in the book that are not in the TV series, so I need to figure out exactly how they translated.
Yeah.
That.
What the state of play is. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And then finally, the final scene is the White Walkers kind of walking past Sam and heading towards the south, we assume, right?
Yeah, towards the wall.
Towards the wall. So,
what do you think of the White Walkers? I think they look like cats, and I don't like it very much. But did you notice in the preview that you see them sort of like looking much more corporeal? Like you see one walking sort of in the shadow of a wood, and it's a guy in makeup as opposed to just a straight CGI thing, and it looks a lot scarier to me. So
interesting. No, I didn't catch that. So
yeah.
So cool. I think that covers basically this entire episode, right?
Yeah. We did it again.
We did it. Yeah. We did the exact same thing we did a year ago.
Yay.
Yay us. So, thinking back, or looking forward, I guess, Joanna, right? Let's think about, we had a conversation about this informally, and everyone I've spoken with about season 3 of Game of Thrones is completely confident where this season is going to end. Are you that way as well?
I'm completely confident about episode 9.
You're completely confident about episode 9, yeah. Every book reader I've talked to Sez, like, I know exactly where this is going, essentially. Yeah.
Everyone knows what episode 9 is going to be.
Interesting.
You know, they've cut book 3 in half. So we all know what episode 9 is going to be. What they do in episode 10, you know, I couldn't quite tell you. But, I mean, I have ideas, but I couldn't quite tell you.
I asked you before what you're sort of the character you're looking forward to the most is, and you said you couldn't say who it was.
Right.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's true. But I am – there's a pair of characters – that were supposed to be introduced in book 2 that they didn't introduce. Everyone's like, where are these two characters? Where are they? And they've been cast for season 3. So, you know, and Benioff and Weiss the entire time were like, don't worry, they're coming. We're just telling the story a little differently. And so those two characters are going to be fun. And then in terms of cool effects, this gives away nothing, but I'm sure you've noticed in the trailer, the flaming sword. You notice that?
I didn't analyze it because I didn't want to be spoiled. Like, I didn't want to be like, oh, wow, that image, I can't. You know, we talked about how if you watch the next time on Game of Thrones, you see something and then when you watch the next episode, you're like, oh, well, when is that going to happen? Right?
Right.
So when I watch the trailer, I kind of consciously try not to remember anything I'm seeing.
Sure.
So.
There's a flaming sword.
There's a flaming sword. Okay.
There's a character that, you know, does that.
Wields it.
Be pretty cool.
That wields it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wields a sword, lights it on fire. So that's going to be pretty exciting. So, yeah, it's going to be great. Or it's going to be terrible, but we'll be here for all of it.
Again, my biggest concern with season 3, the show going forward, is there's going to be more characters, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully some characters will die to make room for them. But...
Fingers crossed, guys.
From what I've heard, right, the book continues to expand outward, and people are doubtful that it's going to lead, like, that all the plot lines are going to be able to be resolved satisfyingly. Go ahead.
But that's the beauty of what I think Benioff and Weiss are going to do in terms of weaving the books together to make a stronger story than even George R. R. Martin told. I know, I said it, but I'm just saying that the way he split some of the books is very unsatisfying, and I think Benioff and Weiss are too smart to deprive you of some of your favorite characters for a whole season.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I think what's going to be interesting is if, like, people who love the series of books, right, need to understand that sometimes what makes for a good book doesn't make for a good TV show or for a good film. Right.
Right.
And most of the time when you have a good book adaptation, it diverges from the book in really, really substantial ways.
Right.
Most of the time. There are some exceptions, but most, like, let's say, exception being No Country for Old Men. That's a good example, where didn't diverge at all, or almost not at all, and the movie was still fantastic.
Yeah.
Then you have books like L.A. Confidential, where it's almost unrecognizable, but both the book and the movie are pretty freaking awesome.
Or right. Children of Men also is, like, basically a completely different story. But what I always say is that I think the two most successful literary adaptations are either you're adapting a novella. So, you know, I think a novella is the exact right length for an adaptation for a film.
Right, right.
Or, as you say, you're willing to keep the spirit of the book but not the letter of the book.
Right.
But the thing is, we're
dealing with a series. I don't know if you know this, Jonah. Game of Thrones fans are really passionate, right? Are you aware?
What?
So we're dealing with people who love their books, right? And you're one of them, and yet we are still friends. We're dealing with people who love the books and won't want to see that many huge divergences from them. But from what it sounds like, in order to tie up the series in a satisfying way, they're going to need to diverge from the books. So I'm just curious how they're going to do it, if they're going to succeed, and if they succeed, what the fan reaction is going to be. That's kind of what I'm looking forward to.
No, and from the book side, I'll say this, that I don't want to speak for all the book readers out there, and I know that there are plenty of people who think that everything George R. R. Martin has ever written is solid gold. But I also anecdotally will tell you that most of the people that I know that love the series have gotten bogged down in, like, book 4. Like,
right.
You know, this is you can still love this series and recognize the flaws in some of the later books in terms of how the storytelling goes.
Right,
so.
Right. So we shall see. That's what makes this exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. And
me too. And yeah, can we say thanks again?
So let's say thanks again to all the people that are making this podcast possible. We really appreciate it. And
huge thanks.
And Joanna Robinson, if people want to email in questions, complaints, agreements, where can they do that?
acastofkings@gmail.com. And just so you guys know, I vet all those emails for spoilers, so to protect Dave.
Yeah, to protect me. So no worries about emailing in spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, try not to email spoilers, but if you do, I am the wall. I am the watcher on the wall. So.
Nice reference. And shall we? But also, right, the rules we established were if you have a spoiler in your email, it will almost definitely not get read on the air. So that's motivation to not include spoilers in your email. And I think that's about it. We are going to try to do a sort of Blu-ray review before season 3 kicks off. Otherwise, you can expect what we have promised is that the recap episode will come probably within a couple days after the episode has aired. And at the very latest, before the next episode airs, right? Are we're committing to that?
Absolutely. But yeah, we're really going to work for, you know, getting it up by Tuesday, I think. Sorry. Dave just did a really good job of being vague and I tried to be specific. Yes, we're absolutely going to try to be up very quickly after the episode.
Exactly right. I like to under-promise and over-deliver. This is my strategy for, you know, my...
For life.
Life. It's my job, my dating life, everything. So, Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
Every day on Pajiba.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at QuitYourJRob.
Find me at Twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. And thanks to SlashFilm.com for making this podcast possible. I'm David Chen here with Joanna Robinson from A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys later.